Lee Burnham, and you're listening to Facts on Radio Facts. This week, pie in the sky. We look at Hungarian free radio and the drug connection with London's pirates. More washing machine repair tips, computer viruses, and new hope for acetate discs. Lots more features in the programme as well, and sadly we have to announce that Radio Facts will be closing down soon. The Department of Communications in Dublin has told us that Radio Facts is causing some embarrassment to the Republic. They now wish unlicensed activity to cease, and we believe the long-term interests of Radio Facts are best served by closing down. We have contemplated ignoring the request, but there is hope that independent shortwave radio licensing will be considered in the future. Unfortunately, we can think of no other place to go to that would allow Radio Facts to continue to operate in a professional way. All the 44 people involved in Radio Facts, including myself, would like to thank you, our listeners, for the 3,000 letters of support for the project you've sent us each year. If that number of letters went to members of Parliament, then perhaps independent shortwave radio would happen sooner rather than later. The other person you might write a nice letter to, saying how much you value what Radio Facts did and requesting a license, is the Minister for Communications, Dublin 2, in Ireland. So get to that now, and we've opened a special phone line where you can record your opinions and reactions for broadcast. Call us now on 0483 272 888. And be quick now, because there's not much time left. And while I'm talking to you, I'll remind you about the Radio Facts t-shirts. I now have a couple in front of me. Wish I could show you them. If you're interested in the design, send us a stamped dress envelope, and I'll put a copy of the design in the post to you. But I can assure you it's a cracker. It's a sort of old-fashioned radio with a valve. I should run a competition to which a valve it is. However, the slogan is Britain's number two shortwave station, and you can have one for £9.99 to the usual address, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. That's Radio Facts t-shirts. Write to us at Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. And if you've got anything else to say to us, if you'd like a station card, then please enclose 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1, and you'll get a station card, as I said, technical information sheets, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. So get writing. It's 6205 3910 and 12255.
Keep your eye on me.
Here's a bit of fun from the Audio Media editorial by Paul White. Analog recording can sound very good, but no, it has to be tinkered with. And no sooner did it work properly than people were developing oral exciters, multi-band compressors, and goodness knows what else to reintroduce some of the more nostalgic side effects that beset whatever preceded it, in this case valves. Now we have affordable digital audio recording on disc and tape, but already people are complaining that while it is clean, quiet, durable and controllable, it doesn't have that certain something that analog had. Before you know it, the backroom boys will be out with their DSP chips trying to simulate the phase smearing, wow and flutter, modulation noise and such like that made analog recordings sound the way they do. And if we outgrow 16-bit sampling, and everybody does everything with 20-bit resolution or higher, you can bet that somebody somewhere will want that nice old-fashioned crunchy 16-bit sound they used to have back in the 20th century. I'll leave you to ponder on that thought. It's quite an entertaining point.
New hope for restoring old acetate discs. The essentials of tape recording were developed in Germany before and during World War II. In the 1920s, Fritz Fleumer, an Austrian based in Dresden, was working on the production of decorative cigarette papers by coating them with metallic dust. It occurred to him that a tape coated with ferric material could be used to carry audio signals through electromagnetic induction, a technique already well known, though only used up to then with wire or solid steel tape. He patented this new tape and a machine which would record and play back as early as 1928. By the mid-1930s, AEG had developed a production model tape recorder, and BASF, still very much in this line of business today, had begun the production of quarter-inch ferric-coated plastic tape. No one elsewhere paid much attention, and so it was with some surprise that the Allies captured various quite sophisticated tape recorders towards the end of the war, and were thus able to explain how Hitler had apparently been broadcasting a speech in one location when he was thought to be somewhere else. One of these Tonschreiber machines was confiscated by a British Army officer who was also a radio amateur. In May 1945, he made what appears to be the first extant off-air tape recording of a BBC programme, and in 1946, the only known recording of the famous music hall double act, Nat Mills and Bobby. These may be heard at the National Sound Archive. Although very convenient, tape recorders still had a little way to go before high-quality music recordings could be made, and so disc recorders continued in use throughout the 1950s for most professional recording in the UK. Disc recording was invented by Emil Berliner in the 1880s, and in the 1930s, a convenient form of instantaneous recording using portable disc cutting equipment was perfected by Cecil Watts in conjunction with the BBC. Up until then, recordings had been made in studios using a wax disc, from which metal masters had to be cast and shellac discs pressed before the results could be played back. Now, using existing disc-cutting technology, music and speech could be recorded and instantaneously played back using the same disc. In America, these discs are often called instantaneous discs. In the record industry, where they gradually replaced wax discs for the production of masters in the 1950s, they are often called lacquers, because they consist of a metal or glass core coated with lacquer into which the grooves are cut. But most people in the UK call them acetates, on the assumption that the lacquer is cellulose acetate. In fact, they are coated with a compound based on cellulose nitrate, or sometimes gelatine, but few seem to have noticed this. Acetates are interesting to the sound archivist, because they usually carry unique recordings. Most of the world's major sound archives have large collections of them, and the NSA has about 8,000 altogether, over half emanating from the BBC. But they are not a good long-term prospect, as the lacquer gradually decomposes, so their contents are routinely copied onto tape if required permanently. At the NSA, an Operation Acetate project, funded by the British Library's Preservation Service, has been making gradual progress on this work. Eventually, the lacquer shrivels up and peels off the core. But in earlier stages of deterioration, the lacquer often shrinks and cracks while remaining flat and in contact with the core. Such discs cannot be played with a conventional stylus. But for several years, researchers have attempted to develop a means of reading the information in the grooves using laser optics, similar to those now commonplace in CD players. Working machines have been made, but unfortunately, the laser, however well focused, has been unable to distinguish between wanted and unwanted information in the grooves, and so playback has been overwhelmed by a loud roar. However, a possible solution was demonstrated at the Audio Engineering Society's convention in March this year. Professor Philippe Robert and colleagues at the Swiss Institute of Technology at Lugano have built a playback mechanism based on a 124 micron fiber optic cable, which tracks round the upper part of the groove, but is only a fraction of the weight of a normal stylus. The cable can be adjusted to pick up wanted information to the exclusion of unwanted, and light emitted from the end of it is then processed using conventional CD circuitry. It also makes a good job of replaying broken 78s stuck together with adhesive tape. The new machine relies largely on off-the-shelf components, so it should be affordable if its early promise is fulfilled and a manufacturer takes it up. That's Alan Ward in playback.
Here's a report from the British Association Science Festival in Southampton by Tim Radford, science editor of The Guardian. The Babylonians had a rough idea, and 4,000 years ago the Egyptians worked out that it was more or less 256 divided by 81. The Bible in 1 Kings 7:23 got it rather wrong and called it 3. Who believes everything you read in the Bible, so you see. Last year, the Chudnovsky brothers calculated it to 2.16 billion decimal places, while the traditional school formula is simply 22 divided by 7. But fascination with pi, the ratio between the diameter and circumference of a circle, goes on forever, rather like pi itself. According to Dr. Roger Webster of the University of Sheffield, who traced the history of 3.141592, etc., etc., for the British Association yesterday, 1 Kings refers to the circle of 10 cubits diameter and a circumference of 30. This would suggest a backward trend, he said. In 240 BC, Archimedes set the pattern for the next 2,000 years by imposing a polygon with 96 sides on a circle and established that pi was bigger than 3 and less than 3.4, but he was only correct to the second decimal place. In 480 AD in China, Su Qingqi came up with a number correct to 6 decimal places, only going wrong in the last digit. He had a bright spot on the moon named after him. In 1610, a Dutchman took pi to 35 decimal places. It took his whole life, and he had it inscribed on his gravestone. He used the Archimedes method of a polygon inside a circle. Do you know how many sides the polygon had that Ludolf van Kulin put it in to get this accuracy? Said Dr. Webster. Wait for it, 5 billion sides. But when the calculus of the German Gottfried Leibniz in 1646 changed the pattern of calculation from geometry to number manipulation, the pursuit of pi really took off. In 1699, someone got it 71 decimal places, and 7 years later, someone else broke the 100 decimal place barrier. In 1761, Johann Lambert, a Swiss German, proved that pi was an irrational number. It might repeat for a stretch, but there would always be new sequences. Early in the 19th century, a German boy called Johann Days turned up. As he could calculate the product of 2 8-digit numbers in 54 seconds, he was an obvious person to plug into pi. At 16, a Viennese professor did just that, and within 2 months, Days found pi to 200 decimal places. As one of his biographers said, he didn't know the difference between pi and apple strudel, but he just did as he was told.
days had withdrawal symptoms once he had finished and calculated log tables for seven places from 1 to 1.5 million in a week. The German mathematician Carl Gauss asked him to reduce all numbers between 3 million and 5 million to their prime factors and arranged for Hamburg's Academy of Sciences to pay days. Gauss gets his name in the record books as the first person in history to arrange for people to pay for computer time, said Dr. Webster. Then in 1873, an Englishman calculated pi to 707 places, and the Palace of Discovery in Paris built a circular gallery adorned with all 707 numbers. Unfortunately, in 1945, a bored wartime fire watcher checked the figures and found they were wrong from the 528th place. In 1949, an early computer pushed the record up to 2,037,000 places in one 30-hour burst. The brothers David and Gregory Chudnovsky, working on their supercomputer, then took the record to 2.16 billion places in New York. Nobody knows why mathematicians find pi so compulsive. There was an Edinburgh professor who could recite the 707 decimal places, including the incorrect 180, and one performer spent a whole day reciting the value of pi on Indian radio. The search for the ultimate accuracy of pi will literally be never-ending, but anyway it may not be helpful. As Dr. Webster pointed out, pi to a mere 39 decimal places would be enough to compute the circumference of a girdle around the universe to within the accuracy of the radius of a hydrogen atom. Sometimes I wonder why they bother.
Museum warehouse to be a showpiece. A new store for the Science Museum at Rorton, Wiltshire, will be such an advance on present storage facilities that it will almost be an exhibit itself. For £2.75 million, a 3,200 square metre store is being built in the grounds of the old RAF station near Swindon, where the museum already uses five former hangars to keep some of its bulkier material, such as aircraft, trams, and the larger ranges of steam engine. Not only will the store, on which building begins in September, have an electronically controlled environment to preserve such items as early telephone switchboards and radar equipment, but there will also be a specially devised system of access. Because the objects are so large and immovable, visitors will be taken to them using computer technology and robotic transport. Visitors will key in the details of the item they want to see and be taken to it on a computerized trolley. We believe it is the most up-to-date conception of a science museum facility, says Suzanne Keane, the museum's head of collection management. The new store, which will take over from the rented one at Hayes, West London, and should be completed by next June, is part of a major program initiated by Dr. Neil Cossens, the director, of which perhaps the most important component is not the new store, but Miss Keane. Collections management is a new department created after a National Audit Office report 4 years ago criticised the way collections were accounted and cared for in national museums. For the first time in a national museum, one department will have responsibility for monitoring the life of an object from its acquisition, cutting across the usual departmental boundaries. Miss Keane, who was the keeper of conservation at the Museum of London before her new appointment, says the conservation of science and technology exhibits is far more complex than for art objects, and we have a lot to learn. How do you conserve computer software, for instance? Miss Keane has 29 conservators and technicians in a museum where, 3 years ago, there was but one scientific officer. There is no national training in the conservation of scientific and industrial collections, and 3 years ago the museum began its own course, which is about to produce the first graduates. The Rorton store will be fully open to the public within 4 years of its opening. The five open days a year for two of the hangars will continue. Simon Tate writing about new storage facilities for the Science Museum in The Times.
Definitely somewhere to go and visit. Let's have a look at the latest issue of Communicate. And inside the front page, Mike Terry reports, a $4.99 paper book by Dave Cash, one of Capital's longest established DJs, who's written a novel based on his intimate experience of UK commercial radio, which those of us who are old enough to remember started on board Radio London. The novel is based on the premise that a London station with an adult contemporary format of album tracks, classic 45s, and quality pop singles could have been introduced when LBC and Capital started in 1973. Whilst being a work of fiction, reference is made to living characters, for example a comparison of the ratings for Nigel Beresford Clark, who is the CRFM star jock, with Capital's Kenny Everett. There are some quite surprising revelations about the politics of the industry, IBA controls, and the finances of running a highly successful radio station. With such a mix of pseudonyms and real-life characters, it would be interesting to know how close elements of the story are to reality. Whilst the book is unlikely to win a literary prize, it is highly readable and gives a fascinating insight into the world of radio. The book was easily found in John Menzies, and I'm enjoying reading it at the moment, and he commends it to BDXC members. And Tom Reed has been busy analysing listening times from last month's communication, and he has supplied a chart showing the most popular times for DXers to bend their ears around their receivers. Not surprisingly, the peak hours are in the evening, with 57 listeners between 21.30 and 21.59 GMT. This peak builds up slowly from a hard core of listeners at 5 o'clock in the evening and dramatically falls after 1 o'clock at night. What surprises me is there are members actively DXing all through the night. There is a peak in listening between 9 and 9.29 on Sundays due to the land-based pirates. Thanks, Tom, very much for compiling that. And further in, some other news. In Austria, now that FM coverage of Austria is complete, engineers of the Austria Rundfunk have been debating whether to switch off 1476 medium wave, a transmitter of 600 kilowatts located just outside Vienna, which currently airs the Österreich 1 service. During the evening hours, there are regular announcements being made in German on that medium wave service only, asking listeners to register their existence. There's a competition with a prize of compact discs for the reception report from the most distant listener. If there's no response or the range of listeners stops just outside the Austrian border, ORF may silence 1476. And what else is there in here? Something else I marked? Yes. In Russia, radio station Hope has been heard at 7 until 9 on 7280 and 15340. It's a new radio station recently taken to the air from Moscow. It's the mouthpiece of women's public organizations in Russia and has been set up by the Russian Women's Union and a charitable fund called the International Foundation for the Protection of the Health of Mother and Child. Programs are in Russian and focus on women's and family issues. And it describes itself as a radio station for family listening. And Radio Allah has said in a letter that the name Allah means wings. There's been much speculation as to what it meant, the last being the initials of the station owner. And you can hear that on 684, medium wave, 1386, and 1494 in evening hours. And also in here, for the forthcoming edition of the popular BDX publication Radio Stations in the UK, they're looking out for good quality copies of recent local BBC and independent station QSL cards and logos. If any members can help, nor anyone listening to Sparks, then please send the copies to Dave Kenny. If you send originals, these will be returned after they've been copied. And if they have too many for publication, they'll put it in the Communication magazine. Yes. That's always a good read, Communicate magazine. I look forward to receiving the next one of them. Hello to A. Stevens, who says, I tuned in today to Sparks, which I heard about pirates on FM. I've never heard anyone on FM in Cardiff. I was 14 when I first tuned into Radio Caroline. I knew then that commercial radio was right. I now believe that Radiofax is right on shortwave, but I think it needs to be advertised a bit more that you are on shortwave. I've told some people where I work that a pirate station operates on shortwave that they did not know about. Every success in the future. Thanks very much, and of course you can write to your MP saying that you think it's right for Radiofax to be on shortwave, because a lot of people agree with you. That's Mr. A. Stevens. And now Derek Norrie has sent in a cutting. Just a few lines to say thanks for using the bits of my letter from the Shropshire Star, so here's some more. I enjoy very much your programmes, but stop being nasty to satellite radio. OK, it might be expensive to get the signal up there, but how much would a 1 kilowatt transmitter cost if you didn't happen to have one? Well, we built one. You can't build a satellite receiver quite so easily. As for receivers with as for receivers at a rally in Birmingham earlier this year, you could get an Astra system with tunable audio for £75, and I bet that's a lot less than most of the HF receivers that you'll listen to on dot dot dot. I think with this discussion could go on forever, but sadly the satellite people might be winning for the foreseeable future unless some more lobbying goes on. And finally, I picked up an interesting little pocketbook at Tandy, says Derek, called Engineer's Mini Notebook Communications Projects. That gives some circuits and building instructions for simple shortwave receivers, 700 kHz AM transmitters, Morse antennas, and much more. Most are very straightforward, using things like 741s, 555s, and transistors. Not bad for £1.59. The Tandy order code for that, incidentally, is 2765105. All the best back to Derek Norrie. So he's cutting rescuers hindered by radio chatter. Cows Week organisers today criticised yachtsmen who blocked an emergency radio channel with social chit-chat, while rescuers attempt to save one of the two competitors who died. Brian Walton, aged 35, from Washington, Tyne and Wear, drowned after being washed overboard from the yacht Mephisto in gale-force winds. He was plucked from the sea by another crew, but was certified dead on arrival at the Royal Naval Hospital Haslar in Hants. It took 30 minutes to get him out of the sea, while desperate rescuers were frustrated in calling coast guards by other yachtsmen, clogging the emergency radio channel with chit-chat. And a red-faced BBC Radio 3 presenter apologised to listeners for saying the F-word on air recently. Some rang to complain after Natalie Ween swore as she was presenting In Tune, one of the new programmes designed to make the station more populist. She forgot to link into an interview and said, "Oh, I forgot to say what it was." A Radio 3 spokesman said Miss Ween's microphone appeared to have been left on by mistake. Natalie apologised for her Anglo-Saxon expletive after the next piece of music. She's very sorry she let the word slip out. Because the programme is live, mistakes do happen. This is part of the new lively Radio 3, and we are now much more in tune with everyday life. But we didn't mean to be that much in tune. And apparently the level of complaints about her F-word have been so high that it's given some evidence that Radio 3's audience has gone up in the drive time periods. Here's a letter from Daniel Drysdale in Lannan, Llanelli in Dyfed in Wales. "I've written to you before. My name is Daniel Drysdale. Here are some DX loggings. Call FM 94.5, Touchdown FM 94.1, Trans FM 105.4, with bad reception, and Destiny 99.5, probably raided. Read TST Rock from Congleton. I cannot hear any of the stations featured in the bulletin, however they were all correct. Legal stations KISS FM 100, LBC Crown FM 97.3, GLR 94.9, this is from Wales, remember. I listen to your station from the above address, with fair to good reception. Another DX report, the time signal station in Canada logged at 5:54 hours GMT, frequency not specified. And regarding Tarn, the hardcore rave station that someone wrote about from Birmingham, please could they write to Radio Facts and if possible send some of the recording to me. He'd like to hear Tarn, a hardcore rave station in Birmingham, if anyone would like to record some via us. And Daniel's blind, incidentally, and he dictated the letter to his grandmother. Thanks very much for that, and hope someone gets in touch with you. And sorry I read it out a bit late, but we've been flooded with mail recently. Mike Brown has written in publicising Prospero, which is a magazine for retired BBC staff. However, there are still gaps in those entitled to receive it. Quite a number of people I know were not advised of its existence before retiring, me included. I get many letters and phone calls each year giving me names and addresses, which I pass on, so they can go into the computer mailing list. If you know of an old colleague who would like Prospero, please ask him or her to get in touch. In the meantime, please keep sending in articles and photographs. Photographs are returned undamaged, so don't be afraid to send in those treasured prints. Articles, letters and photographs can be sent to Mike Brown, 127 Birkbeck Road, Enfield, Middlesex, EN2OEE. That's to go in Prospero. Mike Brown, 127 Birkbeck Road, Enfield, Middlesex, EN20EE. And Ralph Bradley has sent in something from the news file section of Computer Shopper magazine. And he says, thank you for the History of Computing prize, which I won in your recent competition. This is Intel's retaliation to AMD, Cyrix, and Texas Instruments challenging its one-time monopoly of the PC CPU. The overdrive products are intended to take the upgrade process away from the dealers and manufacturers and into the hands of the average PC user. The first 169-pin 486SX chip slots into the overdrive socket of suitable 16, 20 and 25 MHz machines and immediately doubles the processor speed. The chips are in fact simply replacement CPUs based on the existing 486DX2 technology. In theory, they can be plugged into non-overdrive machines by simply removing the old processor and slotting in the new one, although this can result in motherboard damage. More importantly, it won't be possible on the new plastic 486SXs which are soldered onto the board. However, the potential for this activity may force down the prices of high-end machines as people realize the possibility of buying old 486SXs and souping them up. Recommended retail prices for overdrive chips are £359 for the 16 and 20 meg doublers and £459 for the 25 meg upgrade. Intel's intention for the overdrive project is that it will form a whole upgrade strategy, rather than just a means of chip speed doubling. With this in mind, each generation of machines will have an overdrive socket to allow the next generation's technology to be implanted when it arrives. For the 486SX, this happens to be DX2 chip speed doubling. And it's also a way of Intel to get their name known in the household, and they've been advertising on television over the past few months. So thanks very much, Ralph Bradley, for sending that in. And he's got his Sparks RadioFax logo that he puts on his envelope, which I'm very impressed with. Also, hello to Richard Henderson, who's in Ulness, Rossshire in Scotland, and Mike Pratt in Norton St. Philip, Bath in Avon, and Bob Baird, who's in Edinburgh, in case you missed me reading your letters the other Friday. We've really had quite such a lot that I thought I'd do some on Friday as well.
Me to breathe and it's love.
Thermometer to replace thermocouples. Up until now, the metal thermocouple has been the mainstay for industrial temperature measurement. The semiconductor industry uses many in diffusion and oxidation furnaces. If Johnson Matthey have their way, the situation is about to change, because they have introduced on show at the recent vacuum and semiconductor processing show a fiber optic based thermometer called the OFT, for optical fiber thermometer. The OFT is claimed to offer significant advantages over thermocouples in many demanding applications. It uses a quartz or sapphire fiber optic light guide to transfer the characteristic black body radiation from the region being measured to a photodetector. The OFT uses a platinum tip at the hot end of the fiber to produce local black body radiation as a means of making the measurement independent of the radiation characteristics of the local hot region materials. The hot end of the fiber also has a platinum thin film coating. The OFT complements Johnson Matthey's existing range of metal thermocouples, which it will continue to manufacture. The benefits of the OFT are many. One version of the new thermometers can be used at temperatures up to 1300 degrees centigrade, with an accuracy of plus or minus 0.1 degrees centigrade, compared with the plus or minus 2.5 degrees for the metal types. The resolution of the OFT at 1300 degrees is better than 0.01 degrees. Another attribute relates to aging. Metal thermocouples are prone to drift when they are subjected to continuous high temperatures. This drift is caused by diffusion occurring in the thermocouple junction. The OFT drift is significantly smaller because the emissivity of the black body tip is not so critically dependent on small changes in the tip. Physically, the OFTs can be more densely packed than metal thermocouples, and they are easy to position, not requiring the inflexible ceramic tubes or beads to insulate the metal wires. The electronic interface has a number of interesting features. Originally, the stability of the radiation photodetector as a function of temperature was maintained by mounting it on a thermoelectrically cooled plate. That technique has now been abandoned in favor of electronic means of correcting for any changes. To simplify the application of the OFT, its output can be made to look like the characteristic EMF of any of a number of metal thermocouples. In operation, the lower thermal mass of the OFT makes it more responsive to discontinuous temperature changes of the measured region than the metal equivalent. Since the OFT relies on optical rather than electrical transmission for temperature measurement, it is immune to electromagnetic interference. Thus, the OFT could find use in plasma processing operations. A new optical fiber thermometer described in Electronic Engineering.
Hello to everyone who is at the Milton Keynes and District Amateur Radio Society car boot sale. And Paul Brickhill wrote in to say he had a stand there with a skull and crossbones on a Morris Minor van. And he says, give the museum a plug, which is the National Vintage Wireless and Television Museum, overseen by a charitable trust, was set up in 1984, showing most of its large collection of vintage broadcasting items to the general public in Dedham in Essex. The museum is now relocating to a permanent home at High Lighthouse in Harwich, and will be opening in October 1992, housing a permanent collection of wireless and television receivers, items of broadcasting history, and an extensive sound and vision archive. The museum is set out in a series of room sets, tracing the history of broadcasting from the early experiments of Marconi and Baird to the present-day developments in satellite broadcasting. One floor of the museum is dedicated to the history of offshore broadcasting and will be of particular interest to visitors of the Offshore Radio Convention. If you'd like further information or would like to become a member of the Friends of the Museum Society, please fill in the application. Well, this was at the recent Offshore Radio 1584 event down in Southend. No, Walton-on-the-Naze, I think it was. And so, if you'd like to join the Friends of the Museum Society, you have to enclose a stamped address envelope and send to the National Vintage Wireless and Television Museum Trust, High Lighthouse, Harwich in Essex, for more details. And the curator of the museum is Mr. A.J. O'Neill.
Drugs rings muscle in on pirate radios in the Independent on Sunday. Organised drugs syndicates have begun setting up pirate radio stations to advertise illegal raves that can net up to £200,000 a night. Police and Department of Trade investigators say criminals are moving onto the airwaves to circumvent police action to block the illegal pay parties. Figures show an increase in pirate radio activity. Radio investigation officers who track down pirate transmitters are understood to have encountered unprecedented levels of violence. A threat was made to throw one team from the roof of a block of flats, while others raiding stations have been targeted with blocks of concrete from high-rise buildings. By using pirate stations, the organisers can broadcast hours of popular dance music, which in many cases is not played by nor stayed legal stations. After it has attracted an underground audience, the station begins announcing details of the illegal rave, the venue of which is disclosed at the last minute. Once the plans have been revealed, the station packs up and moves on. Other pirate stations are believed to organise legal parties in clubs, providing a ready market in which associates can supply drugs. It is illegal to advertise an unlawful pay party, so the respectable radio stations won't broadcast details, said Detective Chief Inspector Alan Burrell, head of the former Midlands Pay Party Intelligence Unit. It was disbanded in May. Pirate radio stations are now being seen as a way to pass information to all and sundry without interference from the police. The penalty for holding an event without an entertainment licence is £20,000, or 6 months in prison. But some organisers, who can make hundreds of thousands of pounds per rave, simply view that as one of their overheads. The Radio Investigation Service, RIS, part of the DTI's Radio Communications Authority, is responsible for tackling radio piracy under Wireless Telegraphy Acts, amended by the 1990 Broadcasting Act. It has powers to seize radio equipment and prosecute the pirates. Those found guilty could face up to 6 months in jail and, from October, fines of up to £5,000. The penalties are often sufficient to deter the enthusiast who sets up a crude device in his front room. But the RIS is finding that they do not deter organised criminals. All the components necessary to build a transmitter can be bought in most electronic stores for less than £200. Once this is attached to an aerial, power supply, microphone and record and CD decks, the broadcasts can begin. The DTI investigators usually become involved when radio users complain about interference or, more disturbingly, when emergency communications are affected. Dance music has increasingly become an industry for hustlers, said Lindsay Whisker, head of music at KISS FM, the London-based dance music station that began life as a pirate operation in 1985, before winning a license in 1990. They are getting into pirate radio because of the money they can make, not from advertising, but from organising club nights or unlicensed raves. It's quite simple. If they get 1,000 people to pay £20 a ticket for a rave, then they've made a lot of money. Then they sell Coke at £2.50 a can. They have buddies who will go in and peddle their wares. People would not dream of going to a rave without taking something. Girls are part of it. Taking a tab of E, ecstasy, is as much a part of it as dancing or chatting up a girl. The whole buzz comes from dancing as long and hard as you can, but violence has come onto the scene because of the drugs. Edward Lee, Under Secretary of State for Technology, said the use of pirate radio was not harmless fun. Interference from crude transmitters spoils reception for radio listeners and affects the emergency services' communications. The organisations behind the pirate stations and the businesses that advertise on them will be pursued. Any broadcasters inciting criminal acts would be liable to prosecution by the police, said the minister. Detective Chief Inspector Burrell said the use of pirate radio was the next step in a natural progression of organised promotion using all the electronic and communications equipment available. The monitoring of pirate radio broadcasts has actually become a good source of intelligence, he said. There is so much money involved that organised criminal elements inevitably get involved, and pirate radio communications are harder to stop than fly posters or mobile phones. We have seen illegal raves with up to 7,000 youngsters, many of whom think nothing of spending £100 a night. Admission ranges from £15 to £30. If you have 7,000 kids there, that's an instant tax-free £105,000 to £210,000. Then there are the amphetamines that the ravers take to keep dancing all night at £20 to £30 a time. And because ecstasy in particular dehydrates you, there are cans of soft drinks at about £2 a can, and each kid will buy four or five of those. The money to be made is quite startling, he said. The use of pirate broadcasting has become attractive to the pushers for three reasons. It is very inexpensive, it bypasses licensed stations which would not advertise illegal raves, and it is anonymous. Touchdown Radio, a pirate station operating in London since April, organises its own club nights in London, but at licensed and legal venues. One of its disc jockeys, DJ Space, said drugs inevitably crept onto the scene, but without the consent of the station. Over the mobile phone the station uses to pass on rave information to its listeners, he added, "There are drugs in all walks of life, but we are just in this for the love of the music." When asked to confirm that Touchdown was a pirate station, he replied, "Absolutely. We have been going since April without being raided, which is a long time for a station. We are rigged up in such a way that they might be able to find the aerial, but we will get away with the transmitters before they catch us. We'd be able to save most of our gear in a raid. They'd have the aerial, but we'd have gone." He said a DJ at a nightclub organised by a pirate radio station might earn £50 for a one-hour stint. The club and station might share takings, but he argued that they would not be high. And he said the sale of drugs was nothing to do with the station. It is possible someone who wants to sell drugs could organise it as a package, but big illegal raves are hard to put together these days because the police are on top of them so quickly. The story behind why some pirate stations play such awful music these days, written by Steve Boggan in The Independent on Sunday.
Showing your age there, Trevor, I think Touchdown is an excellent station, very reliable. I can see why they've been on so much if they haven't been raided. So, in The Guardian, do it yourself, switch emphasis, Gareth Perry, applies some simple science to appliances. Most people spend a lot of money calling in repairmen with household appliances breaking down. It's an understandable panic reaction, but many faults can easily be cured just by switching off the machine, disconnecting it from the electricity supply and undoing a handful of screws. The fault is invariably quite evident at first glance. A broken drive belt, for example, doesn't need any special diagnostic skills. Never ever try to look into a broken machine before disconnecting it from the electricity supply. Switching off at the plug is not safe enough. If you really can't figure out how to disconnect a fused switch unit on, say, a washing machine, then switch off at the mains. Ignore this peril, this at your peril, but remember the most usual cause of a stalled machine is a blown fuse in the plug. Check the fuse and the connections within it, as well as the ones to the appliance itself. Washing machines are probably the most overworked household appliance. Most have at least a year's warranty, and some have a 5-year optional extension to this. If this is your case, fiddling about with it may make the warranty void. sorry, you'll just have to wait in all day for the service engineer to call. Like humans, older models can behave badly in a number of ways, one of the most common being a refusal to drain off the water after the final washing cycle. You may be able to get rid of the bulk of the water by turning the programmer straight to the spin and draining portion. If you can't, prepare for a flood. Disconnect power and turn off the water supplies, usually red and blue hosed taps leading into the machine. Remove the back of the machine and check the filter for coins, buttons, etc. Unfasten and remove the inlet and outlet hoses and look for bigger obstructions here. This could solve the mystery of the missing odd socks. Or it could simply be the hoses kinking when the machine is pushed back into a tight space below a work surface. If the pump doesn't sprint freely and its connections are sound, it's probably had it. Disconnect it, remove it, and take it to the local dealers for an exact replacement. Front doors leak because the rubber seals around them have perished. Fit a replacement. It helps to gently warm it first with a hairdryer. Banshee screams during the spin cycle indicate worn or slack rubber drive belts. Don't try to adjust the tension. They've probably stretched too much. Simply replace them. The serial number is usually on the belt, but even a new belt can get greasy, so wipe it with a dry cloth. If the water in the machine remains cold, it's probably a faulty heating element. These can be tricky to remove and expensive to replace, so you might as well call in repairman. Machines that overfill usually have a faulty air pressure switch, probably caused by a blockage in the pipe running into the switch. Detach and blow through it. Don't suck. Your second best friend, the tumble dryer, also suffers from blockages. The main filter, which traps lint and fluff, needs cleaning out before every session. Otherwise, the contraption can overheat, burning out the quite expensive heating element. Filters slotted into the inside of the drawer are easily accessible and removable. Otherwise, it's a mini potholing expedition to reach it at the back of the drum. Replace broken or torn filters, or risk a load full of clean washing impregnated with a blowback of brownish fluff and cat hairs. Squeaking machines probably have bearings which have been dried out by the same hot air that dries the clothes. As long as the tension on the drive and the fan belts are all right, a few drops of light oil on the bearings will work wonders. But the bearing on the edge of the drying drum seems to be the noise source. If that's the case, do not oil it. If it's made of nylon, lubricate it with a light coating of PTFE spray or a touch of silicon grease for fabric bearings. A dryer which constantly runs cold almost certainly has a faulty thermostat, usually fixed with just a couple of screws. Disconnect and buy another for about £3. The thermostat may just have stuck open, but if the new one fails in the same way, it's time to call repairman. If the motor is running but nothing much is happening in the way of hot air blowing, suspect a broken fan belt. Replace as per exact part number. Don't try to make do with something similar as it may damage the machine. Refrigerators are usually quite trouble-free. If power is reaching the fridge but not cooling it sufficiently, the first check is to see if the condenser evaporator at the back of the cabinet is warm. If it isn't, select a colder setting. If it still doesn't get really cold inside, have the heating element checked professionally. Alternatively, the compressor might have failed. Leave the door open for a few minutes with the temperature set to maximum. The condenser motor should start. If it doesn't, call repairman and tell him you probably need a new one so he can bring it with him. If the little light inside fails to come on, I won't insult your intelligence by describing its replacement. But I make no apologies for warning you just one more time. Always switch off and disconnect before doing anything. And I've found that the most common fault in fridges, which really makes them not worth repairing, is when people have tried to de-ice the ice box with a metal knife and they've cut through one of the little pipes holding the coolant. And that makes it very tricky to fix. Anyway, that's Gareth Perry writing in Weekend Guardian. You're listening to Sparks every Monday and Tuesday, the weekly programme of science, technology and media news. And here now is something for Trevor. week on Sparks, Pie in the Sky, Hungarian Free Radio and the drug connection with London Pirates, more washing machine repair tips, computer viruses, and new hope for acetate discs. Also listen for lots of other features as well as your letters. Sadly, Radio Facts will be closing down soon. The Department of Communications in Dublin has told us that Radio Facts is causing some embarrassment to the Republic. They now wish unlicensed activity to cease, and we believe the long-term interests of Radio Facts are best served by closing down. We've contemplated ignoring the request, but there is hope that independent shortwave licensing will be considered in the future. Unfortunately, we can think of no other place to go to that would allow Radio Facts to continue to operate in a professional way. All of the 40 people involved in Radio Facts would like to thank you, our listeners, for the 3,000 letters of support for the project you've sent us each year. If that number of letters went to Members of Parliament, then perhaps independent shortwave radio would happen sooner rather than later. The other person you might write a nice letter to, saying how you value what Radio Facts did and requesting a licence, is the Minister for Communications, Dublin 2, Ireland. And we've opened a special phone line where you can record your opinions and reactions for broadcast. Be quick and call us on 0483 272 888. That's 0483 272 888. And the Radio Facts t-shirt is now available, which features an old-fashioned radio design and the slogan Britain's number two shortwave station. One of them is £9.99 from Radio Facts. The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6. 7BG, Radio Facts t-shirt, £9.99, with a valve radio design, and the address is Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG, and that's the same address as for letters to Sparks. And if you'd like a station card with artist's impression of the transmitter site and technical details, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1.
More about plans for a Joe Meek Museum. Author Joe Repsch is actively seeking finance for a business plan that would establish the Joe Meek Museum at the Holloway Road home of the legendary record producer who committed suicide after murdering his landlady in 1967. Repsch's concept requires funding of £230,000 to turn Meek's old home, where he recorded classics such as the Tornado's Telstar and Johnny Layton's Johnny Remember Me, into a centre that would include a commercial studio, record shop, lecture room, a recreation of Meek's studio, and a museum. Repsch came to prominence after his biography, The Legendary Joe Meek, was turned into a BBC documentary last year, which charted Meek's life and pioneering work in record production. I see it as being the only museum in the country to specialise in vintage sound equipment, said Repsch. Student engineers could pick up some of that pioneering spirit and appreciate better their 1990s technology by meddling with the kind of equipment that Meek used. Repsch is keen to hear from any interested parties, and his phone number is 081-878-6912. And that was by Joe Hoskin in ProSound News Europe, where they also describe vintage sounds coming alive. Torag Music is a new London studio dedicated entirely to using vintage recording equipment. Operating out of its Shoreditch premises with one live room and control room, the studio sports a collection of old microphones and reverb plates running through a circa 1965 custom-built 10x8 desk. By September, the studio hopes to supplement its equipment with a reconditioned ex Abbey Road EMI Red 17 desk and a BTR-2-3 valve two-track mastering machine to run alongside a yet-to-be-acquired vintage 1-inch 8-track to replace the studio's Tascam half-inch machine. We intend to use the two desks together, said Liam Watson, co-owner of the studio with Josh Collins. The late 1950s EMI Red 17 8x2 mixing desks, most widely used for mobile recording purposes in its day, is widely regarded as the first mixing console being aligned in the new commonplace sideways-on configuration rather than in racks. A new studio already using old equipment, described there by Zenon Schuper. Royal Ruler Gets Back in the Groove by Tim Cooper in the London Evening Standard. Tony Prince is back. Tony who? Radio listeners with long memories will remember him as the Royal Ruler, the veteran disc jockey and zany star of Radio Luxembourg all through the 70s. After 10 years off the air, he's back, playing vintage hits for London's Capital Gold station. Recently, he celebrated his comeback with household names from the 60s and 70s at a rock and roll reunion at Stringfellow's. The 60s stars included Dave Berry of the Cruisers, Cliff Bennett of the Rebel Rousers, Brian Poole of the Tremolos, Mick Green of the Pirates, plus sundry members of the Tornadoes and Vanity Fair. Representing the 70s were Dave Hill and Don Powell of Slade in leather and silly hats. Then there were fellow DJs Dave Cash and Paul Burnett, plus Screaming Lord Sutch in full election regalia and Neighbours heartthrob Stephen Dennis. Tony, aged 48, from Oldham, started spinning discs for the pirate station Radio Caroline in 1966 and spent the whole of the 70s at Radio Luxembourg, rising to become programme director. He has spent the past decade running his own business, producing remixed records for other DJs around the world and running Mixmag, dance music magazine. He acquired a zany reputation through radio stunts, such as suggesting children burn down their schools, and his on-air marriage proposal, which was accepted. Tony Prince, back on air at Capital Gold by Tim Cooper. The subject of computer viruses was recently investigated on You and Yours.
Edward Wilding, editor of Virus Bulletin, monitors the spread of computer diseases and identifies new viruses.
The way in which they propagate is not totally dissimilar to the way in which the AIDS virus or any other human virus spreads. If we think of the use of contaminated body fluids in the case of AIDS, injecting the virus into the body, similarly a contaminated diskette with a virus residing on it can insert the virus into the computer. 3 years ago we were getting perhaps one report a week of an incident occurring in the United Kingdom. Now we're getting about 3 to 4 a day. And these are real people in business and industry suffering real downtime due to virus infection. They are written for mischievous intent at the least and for downright subversive intent at the worst. And after being surveying this for sort of 3.5 years now, I haven't been able to think of a single good thing to come out of computer viruses. They are wasting a lot of people's time. They are causing immense disruption in people's working lives.
But if computers have diseases, they also have doctors, like Dr. Alan Solomon, who track down and destroy viruses. Companies send for Dr. Solomon when they find a virus in their systems. He knows the crippling and costly effects of a virus and quotes an example of the damage inflicted on one company which called him in.
In their particular instance, they were in the export business. And the port that they were working from had 82 juggernauts lined up through the port because for six hours they were unable to do the documentation that the lorries needed to get out. Because they weren't actually continuing their business as normal, turning out the necessary paperwork and invoices and bills of lading and whatever, the lorries couldn't get on the ferries.
So it's not surprising the discovery of a virus can induce panic. Dr. Solomon knows what to do.
It's like finding a needle in a haystack. We have seen people take the approach of burning down the haystack, but if you do that, you have a problem with what you're going to feed your cows on this winter. Burning down the haystack is not a good idea. The damage done by the panic can greatly exceed the damage that's done by the virus itself. One guy came to us and they'd had a virus and they'd gone through their panic stage, in the course of which they'd totally erased the hard disks of about 6 computers, and they'd physically put a pair of scissors through 500 floppy disks. And that was very silly. The virus itself would have done no damage whatsoever. The entire damage was done by the reaction.
When a virus strikes, the afflicted company will turn in desperation to anyone. But how do you tell the doctors from the quacks? The computer industry reckoned it needed independent assessment of the virus doctors and the cures they sell. So it has set up a unit at Bradford University to test antivirus programs and to give programs a clean bill of health before they're duplicated, thus cutting down the spread of viruses. The unit's chief, Dr. Simon Shepherd, has collected about 2,000 viruses against which he tests the claims to cure them.
We assess the software two ways. We assess it against the manufacturer's claims. If they only claim to find 50% of the viruses in existence and the software lives up to that, well, that's fine. We also quantify their software in absolute terms as to how many of our established set of viruses it actually finds, whether it's 98%, 99%, or so forth. Some of them are absolutely hopeless. It is probably fair to say that there's about five which offer a competent level of effectiveness against viruses. So far, we've examined 8 or 9 antivirus software packages, and we have only found one which has been 100% successful, and that is Alan Solomon's antivirus toolkit. This is a devastatingly accurate piece of software, and found, in fact, every single virus that we had in our set.
That report by Roisin McCauley on Radio 4. Riverbed killer identified. An algae that rises from riverbeds to kill fish before returning to the sediment has been identified by scientists. The researchers, who discovered the poisonous organism by chance, believe that the algae could be a key cause of the rising number of mass mortalities of fish in estuaries in Europe, America, and other parts of the world. The discovery has been made by scientists at the North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina. The team claims that the algae, a dinoflagellate, is a new species. Its existence was uncovered when aquarium fish suddenly died a few days after water collected from the Pamlico River was put into their tank. Within 2 hours, the algae changed into non-toxic forms, or cysts, and settled on the tank's bottom. During the deaths in the river of 1 million Atlantic menhaden, a type of herring, the scientists found swarms of the microscopic algae in the water. Less than 1 day later, few toxic algal cells remained. The algae's ability to change swiftly from a poisonous to a benign form may be why its link with mass fish deaths has never before been uncovered, the scientists suggest. That's by Nick Nuttall, technology correspondent of The Times.
Some more letters now, first from Nick Smith, who's in Rossendale in Lancashire. Just thought I'd drop you a quick note about INR2. The second independent radio national service has begun test transmissions on 1215, the old Radio 3 channel from Droitwich, using 200 kilowatts. By the time you hear this, I think they've stopped transmitting again. However, a directional aerial was used, but the orientation is unknown. Reception here in Rossendale is quite usable, although local noise and propagation disturbance is sometimes a problem. The service is due to start early 1993 and will cover 90% of the UK population, with 25 transmitter network, from 100 watts to 200 kilowatts. The high power stations will operate in synchronism. The frequency of 1197 will also be used. More transmitters will be tested shortly, so listen out for that. The programme format will be classic rock, tracks of the 70s and 80s, albums and singles music. They hope to fill the gap between the ILR, FM and AM Gold stations. And they can be contacted by writing to Independent Music Radio Limited, Breakfast TV Centre, Hawley Crescent, London Northwest 1, 8EF. Telephone 071 288 4317, and the project director is Charles Levison. A QSL card will be issued, and a request for suggestions of songs and artists has been made. And Nick also writes, I wonder if you know what the old bands 1 and 3, as used for 405 line TV, are now used for. I was wondering if it was worth modifying some old TV tuners, if there's anything there. Keep up the good work. Best regards. Well, as in the band 1 on 49 MHz, there are baby alarms, if that's what you find fascinating to listen to, or radio car alarms, which let you know via a pager when your car's been nicked. Also, remote control and security, things like garage door openers. And, of course, the 50 meg 6 meter amateur band. And on 46 meg there are cordless phones. And band 3 is supposed to be for mobile radio and PMR trunking, but huge chunks of it are still unallocated. D. Beecher is in Crosford, Dunfermline in Fife, and he says, I heard your transmission on 6205 on the 7th of the 8th, 92. My receiver is a Matsui MR4099. I can hear you quite well with another domestic radio. I'd be interested in having a copy of the simple radio circuit constructed by Tony Rickson. And he includes a stamped addressed envelope for the circuit, so I'll get to that. And another letter. Ralph Bradley says the same, and he's also enclosed some recordings. He'd like a photocopy of the MOSFET receiver, as mentioned on Sparks a few weeks ago. And I'll play some of Ralph's recordings hopefully next week. And going through the mail again, a short note from Victor Best, who's listening in Portadown in Northern Ireland. And also hello to James Robinson, who laments the closure news. And from Cumbria College of Art and Design, very impressive looking, is J. Bainbridge James in Scarside Farm, Bampton, Penrith. And he says, I'm a media student in Carlisle and I like to hear news about the TV and radio industry. Philip J. Catterall from Bucknell in Stoke-on-Trent sends us his QSL card. He's G4OBK, and he says, I've finally got round to sending you a reception report. I discovered you in July 1991, and I suppose I could be counted as a regular listener. I'm currently listening to your replay of an old Caroline tape. It's very enjoyable and takes me back to my teens in my hometown of Leyland, Lancashire. I had an old, even then, CR100 receiver and enjoyed Caroline North, which used to really boom in. These days I'm into amateur radio, got my license in 1982 and I'm still keen. However, 90% of my time is spent listening for DX and hopefully making contacts with that DX. I know your transmitter is located in the north of Ireland, but would like more technical information on the station, power use, type of amplifiers and frequencies. And this that can be found in the information sheet. If I can get some info, I will disseminate on the UK packet radio system, which is useful for letting hundreds of hams know about you. I listen on either a Yaesu FT990 or a Raycal RA1792. Well, what happened to the old, what's it called, CR100? And he says the aerial used is mostly a 31-foot-long ground plane vertical. 6205 is good throughout the day. Plenty of fast fading, but very listenable. 3910 is a must after dark when 6205 gets wiped out from European stations. 73s for now. Keep up the fight for free radio. That's from Phil in Stoke-on-Trent.
Since the BBC announced their plans for the Radio 6 news service on longwave to replace Radio 4, they've been besieged by people complaining about the lack of longwave Radio 4 reception.
Not only is Radio 4 longwave my friend, providing me with information, entertainment and current affairs, it also keeps me sane. Yes, I know Radio 4 is on FM, but...
And Miss McPherson is not alone with this complaint.
My reception's so weak, it's inaudible. What am I going to do? I've been in tears all morning.
Louise Ogle Rush of London is more combative in her approach, but no less heartfelt.
Why, oh why, do you have to change the only media outlet of any quality and standard left to us? Radio 4 is the pearl of broadcasting, and you...
Michael Green, controller of Radio 4, Jacques.
You, together with your colleagues, will be guilty of lowering our standards and catering to the lowest common denominator yet again.
From County Galway in Era, Justin Evans writes to say he's...
Absolutely shocked, horrified, disgusted, dismayed.
I think that just about covers most reactions.
Is this part of some sinister plot to progressively downgrade Longwave by the BBC?
He asks.
Why has Longwave become the dustbin for all the junk programmes like Prime Minister's Questions, 3 weeks of election special, daily Woman's Hour repeats? And now the BBC plans to condemn captive Longwave listeners to a non-stop piecemeal up-to-the-minute news. Don't do this to me, BBC.
And consternation has been recorded from further afield. This being 1992 and all that, it is worth noting that the response of Europe to the proposed alteration has hardly been vive la différence.
Radio 4 is a much appreciated service, not just by the British in Europe,
writes William Jordan from Caen in Calvados,
but also by a huge public that love the English language.
Louise Feinzoen, an expat resident in Parma, in northern France, threatens that all those Eurobrits unable to live without Radio 4 will be obliged to return to Blighty, bringing with them, she continues darkly, more unemployment, less British influence on the continent,
and we can't have that, can we?
And housing shortages. I put these and other points to Tony Hall, Director of News and Current Affairs.
The reason for putting the news on Longwave is because there is a great deal of output on Radio 4 currently, which is far better served by being in stereo sound. And with the best will in the world, I can't say that stereo makes a great deal of difference to most of our news programmes. The reason for the network, though, I think it might be worth getting that clear for the listeners. The reason for the network is twofold. First of all, we want to be able to offer a service that the listeners can't currently have of getting the news on the air quickly when it happens. And in the recent past, there have been a number of occasions, like the resignation of Sir Geoffrey Howe, for example, or when Robert Maxwell went overboard, or the bomb in Whitehall Place, when for very proper reasons of scheduling of built programmes on Radio 4, we weren't able to get the news on quick enough, in enough depth, to satisfy our listeners. And the second broad point is, I think if you look at what we currently offer on our news programmes, our current affairs programmes on Radio 4, and compare them with the diet of news that you get on or get through newspapers, we're not covering enough range of stories at home and abroad about business, about sport, about the arts, about all sorts of things, a richness of stories that I think we can offer on this new service.
Have Messrs. Checkland and Burt not heard of CFAX? If this isn't 24-hour news, what is?
Well, we have heard of CFAX, and it is continuous news. When we asked as a part of the charter renewal process, we asked people what sort of services do they think the BBC should provide. A continuous news network actually came very, very high up their agenda indeed of things they felt we should provide.
We have a letter from Aileen Wright, who asks, did anyone listen to Radio 4 Longwave during the Gulf crisis, an election apart from those who couldn't get FM?
We found that there was a new audience of people there who wanted to listen to what we had to offer.
Part of the feedback programme there, dealing with criticism of the BBC plans which involve Radio 4 losing its Longwave outlet in 1994.
I'm sure they could fit in a few minutes of Spark style science, technology and media news. Maybe I'll have to send them a demo tape.
Trees that burn down to the ground.
radio pirates band together. A report in World Broadcast News from Budapest, Hungary. An unnamed spokesman of the newly set up Hungarian Alliance of Free Radios reports there are now 10 pirate or clandestine FM stations active in Hungary. Three of these, Radio 6 in Budapest, Tilos or Forbidden in Kaposvár, and Subjective in Pécs, mainly run by students, have formed the alliance as part of the Hungarian section of the European Alliance of Free Radios. Perhaps Radiofax should join that. A bit late, though. We'll remain on the air even after the present moratorium freezing the granting of new frequencies is lifted. For we aim to become legal, said a spokesperson. But we don't want to become local community stations, although we'll foster local initiatives, but remain outside the mainstream of commercial and political interests as non-profit-oriented, low-cost youth outlets. Earlier, the pirates intimated that they may apply for a legal status once a new media law is brought in, and asked for a slice of future advertising revenue gained from newly set up commercial stations. This is to enable what they termed independent community radio stations to operate. However, with their illegal activity, they have not gained a very sympathetic hearing. At present, they primarily depend on voluntary donations to air a few hours of daily programming.